Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. As we prepare for the election in November, the 2016 ballot questions take center stage. SDPB's political reporter is Lee Strubinger. He continues to offer insight as you prepare for the voting booth. I asked him to help sort through the basics of the upcoming ballot. Lee Strubinger, welcome to Dakota Midday. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
What is my ballot going to look like in November? It's going to be kind of a full one. Give me an idea of what I have to look forward to.
Sure, certainly. It's going to be, you can pull it up on the Secretary of State's website. You enter in your name and your date of birth. You will end up getting a PDF view of what your ballot looks like. For me, I'm out here in District 32 out here in Rapid City in Pennington County. And on page one is where a lot of the action happens. You got who you can vote for president, U.S. Senate, U.S. Representative, Public Utilities Commissioner, State Senator, State Representative. And then from there on out, starting on page one and then all the way down to page four is all these ballot measures. Well, we'll start with a referred law. Mm-hmm. So a referred law is something that a citizen can go out and gather enough signatures to refer a law that was passed by the legislature. And there must be about 5% of the total vote for governor, that number of signatures. And then it cancels out the law until it comes up for vote in November.
So give me an example of a referred law that's going to be on this ballot and sort of how it originated.
We have two on the ballot this year, referred law 19 and referred law 20. South Dakota political blogger Corey Heidelberger circulated petitions to refer two of these laws. Referred law 20 deals with a provision passed by the legislature regarding a minimum wage increase that was passed in 2014. That provision, it kept the minimum wage for youth at $7.50 an hour rather than increasing. So this summer, youth workers were able to get $8.55 an hour, but depending on how the voters vote again on the minimum wage issue, it could go down to $7.50. Another referred law is referred law 19 that deals with election petitioning changes. It moves the month for circulating petitions back by a month. According to the law, it's from December to early March instead of January to late March. The original intent by the Secretary of State was to give her more of a window of time to look at signatures, but then it went through the legislature. They added some provisions, the signature requirements and that sort of thing. And Corey Heidelberger, who brought the referred law forward, says that this bill makes it harder for independents to gather signatures. So that's why he's referring the law.
But how does it make it harder for independents? Everybody's gathering signatures, right? Regardless of who it is, why is this unfair to independents?
Correct. So it increases the number of signatures that independents have to get.
I see. Okay.
It has to be, I believe it's 1% of all registered independents. Mm. And it also created a provision that if an independent is running for office, Democrats nor Republicans can sign that petition put forth by an independent. And here is Republican Senator Ernie Otten, who proposed that change to the amendment. Here's what he had to say.
So if you're tired of the Republicans for what they're doing, or if you're tired of the Democrats being an independent, I get that end of it. But having said that, when one rejects either party, what then gives them the right to think that they are aloof from everybody else? If you rejected being a Republican and you have rejected to be a Democrat, then why do you think that you should go back to those individuals and get signatures?
And one of the struggles I have with the ballot questions is you think that, you know, we're going to touch on each of these momentarily, and each one seems to be a conversation in and of itself. So just before we move on, referred law 20, I'm still a little vague on that. So the minimum wage was raised, but then the legislature decided to have a separate minimum wage for youth and not. And so Corey Heidelberger and the proponents of referred law 20 are arguing that was not the intent of the law, or am I getting that wrong? Because he wants he wants the kids to make more money.
Correct.
Essentially.
He says voters in 2014 said they wanted the minimum wage to increase and also have cost of living increases as well. And he said, he says the voters passed that loud and clear. And then the next session, the legislature came in and changed the original intent of what the voters wanted, keeping that provision at $7.50 an hour. The people, you know, business owners and the like who are in support of keeping the youth minimum wage at $7.50, they say it makes it easier to hire youth. One of their arguments is that younger workers sort of, they'll come and go pretty quickly. So training them has a lot of costs as well. So starting them out at $7.50 an hour makes it easier for their bottom line. Goes without saying that just because it's $7.50 an hour, it's, you know, the minimum wage, doesn't mean that's exactly what youth make at their jobs. They could make more.
So basically, if I vote yes for that, I'm establishing a youth minimum wage,
and at
I'm saying at what?
At $7.50,
which is lower than the wage for adults.
Correct. And a no vote would say no, we're keeping it how the vote was in 2014.
Okay.
At $8.50 with cost of living increases.
So where do you go if you're a voter? Obviously, we're going to do some work here on SDPB radio, online, on TV, explaining some of these issues. Where else can I go as a voter to sort of see the pros and cons? So at the very least, I know what I am voting for and what I am voting against when I cast my ballot.
The best place to look is definitely the Secretary of State's website. I've almost made it my homepage, if you will, in these last few weeks. It has all the information from proponents and opponents of ballot measures, the Attorney General's explanation, even down to the language of what will happen once these go into effect.
So let's talk a little bit about constitutional amendments. We're changing the state constitution. So give me an idea of how those even get on our ballot.
Same thing as a referred law. You'd go out and you'd gather signatures.
So we're really good at gathering signatures in South Dakota. We've got that system down. If anybody wants to know how to get names on a petition, come to South Dakota. We'll teach you how to do it because we seem to have a system down. What are we looking for in our constitutional amendments?
One of them that we've been reporting on lately was Amendment R, and I believe you guys talked about it on Dakota Midday not too long ago. Constitutional Amendment R adds technical schools to the list of state-recognized post-secondary education entities. There are four of them in the state that receive state money.
And so this seemed like something that I read the governor was for and the entire legislature was for with one strong exception. And who is that voice of opposition?
Republican Representative Elizabeth May was the only legislator to vote against placing Amendment R up for a vote in November. A lot of the narrative surrounding Amendment R was that it was a non-issue. She voted against it, and she says it'll cost the state additional money by establishing a new body to oversee the four technical schools in the state. Now, I said new body. There's some issue with sort of calling it a governing body, but she says it's clear that Amendment R forms a separate governing body for state-funded technical institutes.
I don't know how anybody can argue that. That's what it is. If you read it, that's what it is. And so it's up to people to decide, do they or do they not want to change the Constitution to allow a technical schools to have its own governing board? And if they do, they have to be aware that there is going to be a cost associated with that change.
Let's jump into nonpartisan elections. Give me an overview of what that looks like.
So Constitutional Amendment V hopes to establish nonpartisan elections, much like our neighbors down in Nebraska. Nebraska is a little bit different in how their state house is set up compared to ours. What's interesting is that it's another one of these bipartisan ballot measures. But I talked with Chuck Parkinson, who is a lifelong Republican, and he says Amendment V would give the state's fastest growing demographic a voice, which is independent voters in South Dakota.
There are now 109,000 independent voters in the state, and those voters are really disenfranchised. And I see it as the fact that the essence of representative democracy is voter participation. And if those people cannot participate in that particular process, you're losing the essence of democracy.
Tell me what your work is going to look like between now and November, because you've done some spot news on all these issues. You continue to dig into them, continue to talk to the major players. What do you have coming up for us?
I'm taking some closer looks at the payday lending things that are going on. When I think about all these ballot measures, I sort of lump them into several different groups. So one of the things I'll be doing is I'm going to be looking at how three or four of the measures up for vote would just change the way elections are done in South Dakota. There are those out there. And if they all passed, what would that mean? How would that make South Dakota's elections? How would that make them look? We're certainly, you know, doing our best to try and get down to the heart of it.
Lee Sturbinger, thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to hearing more from you as we march toward the election.
Thank you.